the head of the protective custody camp, which is the area of the camp that held the prisoners, was this SS Lieutenant Tumann, extremely cruel person. He was hated by his men as much as by the prisoners because he was a real sadist, and he hated Janina and did not want to allow her to bring anything in, but she was able to get the backing of the commandant, who wanted to reduce the prisoner mortality rate. But Tumann was always, you know, on her case, looking to find a way to expose her. He believed that she was doing resistance work in the camp, and he very nearly did catch her a couple of times. So, and that was, you know, when it was really key, her ability just to stay completely calm while he was screaming in her face. I mean, she entered the camp with a healthy dose of paranoia, always.
And she always had to be careful. I think we need to all just also remember that no one except Skrzynski, Andrzej Skrzynski, her rescuer, knew that she was Jewish. She was in danger every day from various people. And she writes about this in her memoir, that people had different attitudes, exhibited different behavior, and she could be denounced from among the Polish population. So she had to be very careful, constantly on her toes.
Welcome to Heroes Behind Headlines. I'm your host, Ralph Pizzullo. Our guests today are authors Elizabeth B. White and Joanna Sliwa to talk about their fascinating new book, The Counterfeit Countess, which is the astonishing true story of Dr. Josephine Janina Melberg, a Jewish professor who, during the Nazi occupation of Poland, took on the false identity of a Polish aristocrat named Countess Janina Sokodolska. With guile, bravery, and steely persistence, she persuaded SS officials to release thousands of Poles from the Majdanek concentration camp, and permission to deliver desperately needed food and medicine, and even decorated Christmas trees to thousands more of the camp's prisoners. Incredibly, Dr. Melberg avoided detection and ultimately survived the war and emigrated to the United States, where she became an assistant professor of mathematics. It's my great pleasure to welcome authors Elizabeth B. White and Joanna Sliwa, and to name them, as well as Dr. Josephine Janina Melberg, as today's Heroes Behind the Headlines.
Heroes Behind Headlines with Ralph Pizzullo.
Barry and Joanna, thank you so much for doing this. It's a very amazing book, and what an extraordinary story. The book came about in an unusual way. Can you talk about that for a minute?
Sure.
Because that's a book, a story in and of itself, right?
In a way, yes. So in 1989, I gave a conference paper on Majdanek concentration camp. And afterwards, a historian I didn't know, Arthur Funk of the University of Florida, came up and handed me a package with a carbon copy manuscript on onion skin paper. And he said it was the memoir of a Jewish woman who had helped prisoners at Majdanek.
Yeah.
So I read this memoir after I got back home, and it just tells an incredible story. She claimed that she survived the Holocaust in German-occupied Poland by pretending to be the Countess Sukodolska, a Polish Christian aristocrat. Mm-hmm. She became an official of a Polish relief organization and also an officer in the underground Polish Home Army. So for her relief work, since she had flawless German, she would negotiate with SS and Nazi officials for permission to provide aid to non-Jewish Polish victims of Nazi persecution. Mm-hmm. And particular focus of her work was at Majdanek concentration camp. She relentlessly badgered the SS to let her bring in ever greater quantities of food for the Polish prisoners at Majdanek, to the point that She claimed she was able in 1944 to bring in massive quantities of bread and prepared soup for thousands of prisoners 5 days a week.
Amazing.
And at the same time, she was bringing these deliveries also herself personally.
Yeah.
Into Majdanek. And she was using them as cover to smuggle supplies and messages for members of the resistance in the camp.
Incredible.
So Yanina Mailberg had immigrated to the U.S. In the 1950s and died in Chicago in 1969, where she was a tenured full professor of mathematics at the Illinois Institute of Technology. And after she died, her husband, who died 10 years later, gave the memoir to Funk, Arthur Funk, hoping that he could get it published. And he hadn't been able to, so he thought that maybe since I was writing about Majdanek, I could find some way to use it.
Yeah.
But, I mean, this story was so incredible that I really had to question whether it was true. And I was able to confirm pretty quickly that there was a Countess Suchodolska. She's mentioned in post-war Polish studies of Majdanek and described by former Majdanek prisoners, who talked about how she seemed to understand the German mentality and so was able to win all these concessions from them. And they describe how she would maintain utterly calm and dignified in the face of screams and threats from the SS.
Yeah.
But nowhere could I find any indication that Suchodolska was not her name. She was not a countess, much less that she was a Jew. And so as a historian, I couldn't make any use of this without some kind of verification that it was true.
Yeah.
And at the time, I didn't have the time or the resources, much less the knowledge of Polish required to track down the truth.
Yeah.
And Funk told me that he was giving copies of the memoir to some other archives, some including the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum. So I figured some other scholar with the right resources and skills would find it and, you know, do what was necessary to verify it. Then years passed, decades, Funk died. The story haunted me. And, you know, I worried I was the only historian who knew about it.
Yeah.
Did I have a responsibility, if it was true, to make it known? Because if it was true, it was a really important story.
Oh, absolutely.
And so about 7 years ago, I started looking into it. And I found enough to make me think that Yanina Mailberg really was Countess Suchodolska, but still not enough for me to be able to verify all the claims in the memoir. So in 2018, I sent it to Joanna, whom I only knew by reputation as an expert on the Holocaust in Poland, and asked whether she would be interested in undertaking to verify it. So I'll let her take it from there.
Yeah, Joanna, tell us a little bit about your background, too.
Sure. In 2018, I get a message from my former doctoral advisor, Deborah Dwork, saying that she just met with this historian, Elizabeth Barry White, at the Holocaust Museum, and she learned about this amazing story of a Polish, what appears to be a Polish Jewish woman, who posed as a countess, and Barry is interested in pursuing this. And so would I be interested in being connected to Barry and to discuss this? And I, when I saw this, I said, wow, I didn't know more about the story, but I said, of course I do. I mean, I've never heard a story like that.
Yeah.
And I've read many as a Holocaust historian, right? I've read many, many stories.
Yeah.
So Barry and I spoke, and we instantly understood that this is a story that needs to be told. And there is a larger history of World War II, of the Holocaust, Polish history that should be told through the lens of Yanina's personal story.
Yeah.
And then I would just add that very soon after she started working on it, Joanna did find the definitive proof that Yanina Mailberg was Countess Suchodolska. And we ended up finding that her accomplishments during the war were actually even more remarkable than she revealed in her memoir. And we also realized that her life, so her memoir only covers 1939 to 1944. And her life before and after the war was also really remarkable.
Yeah.
So at first we had thought, well, could we publish the memoir along with some text explaining the larger context? You know, but then we ended up realizing we needed to tell her whole story, you know, a biography and a chronological nonfiction narrative.
Yeah, amazing. Can you talk a little bit about her life before the war? Her life was going on a completely different trajectory. You hear about people like this in history who just seem like the most unlikely people to emerge as such capable heroes, not just heroic, but really effective. And then when faced with horrible circumstances, they just rise to the occasion. Can you talk a little bit about what her life was like before the war?
Sure. Nina Melberg was born Happy Spinner. That was her actual name. She was born, from what we understand and know, in a small town, that Zhuravno, that today is part of Ukraine. But during Janina's birth, it was part of the Austro-Hungarian Empire. Mm-hmm. And then it became Poland. So you could tell like how the geography, how the borders kind of switched where she lived.
Yeah.
And from what we understand, from the snippets of information that we've gathered, and we can talk about how we gathered that information later on, it's a story of itself. Janina grew up in this formerly noble town. So in Poland, there were royal towns, noble towns, villages, right? And this was a noble town.
Okay.
Where her father had connections with the local nobility. He owned the land. And so Janina interacted from a very young age with members of the local nobility. Mm-hmm. He had tutors, so she spoke French, she spoke German, she spoke Polish. We also understand she spoke Russian and Ukrainian, so very multilingual and very educated.
Yeah.
And at some point, she, after her father died, she and her mother moved to Lviv, where she pursued her education. Now, Lviv being a major city in that area, right? Mm-hmm. So she pursued her education there and later on went on to university, where she completed a doctorate degree in philosophy, but with a specialty in mathematics, because mathematics was what she really was her passion, what she loved to do, and what was her specialty.
Yeah.
But in Poland at that time, it was very, very difficult.
I was still going to be my next question.
For a woman to get a PhD in mathematics. So philosophy was, in Lvov, there was this very important intellectual school that she and her future husband were both part of. And it was very open to mathematicians and to women and to Jews.
Yeah. And so she meets her husband while she's studying, correct?
She meets her husband at the university. Mm-hmm. And so Janina graduates in 1928. And a few years later, in 1933, Janina and Henry, at that time, Henryk Melberg, that was his name, mm-hmm. Get married in his hometown of Kopaczynski, mm-hmm. which used to be Poland, now is Ukraine. So at first, the two of them live in Kopaczynski. And after Henry is able to secure a position, they move to Stanisławów, which today is Ivano-Frankivsk in Ukraine.
Okay.
And they live there for some time where he teaches at the kind of gymnasium level, which is kind of like a high school, let's say high school equivalent. And once they are able to secure positions in Lviv, they move to their beloved Lviv because that was the city where their hearts were.
Mm-hmm.
And so Henry and Janina taught, she taught mathematics, he taught French in Lviv until 1939, September 1939, when their lives suddenly changed.
Yeah, everybody's life in Europe changed.
Yeah.
It was a horrible time. Yeah.
And so, you know, it was the start of Germany attacked Poland, and then the Soviet Union joined on Germany's side, and Lviv, where Janina and Henry lived, was occupied by the Soviets. So they had over a year and a half of living under Soviet terror. Yanina had to hide her background as as the daughter of a landowner, because that would have made her a class enemy. And then in at the end of June 1941, the Germans march in, and the full force of Nazi persecution of Jews, including mass murders, begins immediately.
Yeah.
So they suffered under the persecution. Yanina witnessed many horrors.
Yeah.
Then in late 1941, they were on the point of being forced to move into the ghetto in Lvov. So 120,000 Jews were being packed into one tiny rundown area of the city, except they were killing off Jews as they were filing into the ghetto.
Yeah.
And so Henry and Yanina understood what awaited them, that death awaited them in the ghetto, and they were trying to figure out what to do. They thought they were going to go to his parents in Kokochinsa because there was no ghetto there yet. Mm-hmm. And then suddenly they receive a visit from an old family friend of Yanina's, Count Andrzej Kaczynski. Mm-hmm. And he just has arrived from Lublin, a city in a part of Poland that had been occupied by Germany since 1939. And he says, come with me to Lublin.
Yeah.
And once you're there, I can get you papers and work and a place to live.
Uh-huh. Papers showing that she's not Jewish, that she's just
Aryan, Aryan papers. Yes. Yes. Yeah. Right. False papers to cover up.
Right.
So they decided to go with him. And it was a very dangerous journey, several days.
Yeah.
And they had to travel without any papers because as Jews, they couldn't travel. So it was extremely dangerous.
Yeah.
Then in Lublin, she became the Countess. And
that's when she assumed the new identity and the new name.
Yes.
Which she did several times in her life. This wouldn't be the first time. Yeah.
Right.
And Henry finds a job there. So they have it seems like a semi-comfortable life, nothing like what they had before, but, you know, they have food, they have shelter. I mean, there's always danger of being discovered, but the day-to-day life seems to be, under the circumstances, not awful. Is that correct?
Well, it's better than being a Jew, but as Poles, they were still marked for persecution.
Right.
Right. Because the Nazis considered the Poles only to be slightly above the Jews in their racist rankings, you know?
Yeah.
And so as Poles, they were subject to being seized at any time for forced labor.
Yeah.
They could be taken and imprisoned as hostages. They could be killed in bloody reprisal actions. They could be forcibly displaced in ethnic cleansing operations. So the German occupation of Poland was, you know, it cost the lives of 3 million Polish Jews, but also nearly 2 million non-Jewish Poles.
Yeah.
So it was extremely bloody, brutal, persecuted. They had starvation rations for the Poles.
Let's talk about that for a minute, because I don't think a lot of people are aware of, and I wasn't slightly aware of it, but not to this extent, of what the German plan for Poland was, because they had like a very specific plan and everybody was caught up in that, that they were going to basically like Germanify Poland.
The ultimate goal for Hitler right from the beginning was to win Lebensraum, living space, in Eastern Europe. It would stretch from Germany all the way to the Ural Mountains. And this would be space for Germans.
Yeah.
And they were going to establish this racial new order in this area.
Yeah.
The first step in that was to annihilate the Jews. But then the long-term plan was that they were going to get rid of tens of millions of other non-Jewish peoples, including at least 80% of the Poles.
Crazy.
So, of course, one of the groups that was targeted the earliest were the members of the intelligentsia. So teachers, professors, religious leaders, clergy members, right? Yeah. Because those were the leaders. So to destroy opposition, possible opposition to the Nazi regime, that group was targeted. And as we know, both Henry and Yanina were part of that intelligentsia group, and they had to hide that as well. So they were hiding their Jewish identities, but they were also hiding their social backgrounds, educational backgrounds as well. And when we speak about the Nazi policies toward Poland, And to add on to what Barry said, I mean, even living in Lublin at the time, for the Melbergs, that they only Henry knew Lublin. He had before the war. He taught in Lublin at a school there, at a school for girls. So he knew the city somewhat. But during the Nazi occupation, all the street names were changed, Germanized.
Wow.
So even the landscape was being Germanized. Buildings were being destroyed. Monuments, Polish cultural monuments, and places of importance were being destroyed to humiliate Poles and just destroy their culture. So there were many levels of that anti-Polish policy.
Mm-hmm. Right. The idea was they were not just going to wipe Poland off the map. They were going to destroy any vestiges of Polish culture and Polish identity. So that's why they were destroying these monuments and memorials shutting down museums and libraries and looting them or burning their contents. There was a very strict system of apartheid. Poles were, not allowed to go into many of the stores and restaurants. They had to stay in a certain area on public transport. They couldn't marry Germans.
Yeah.
You know, the Polish children couldn't advance beyond elementary school. And even what schooling they got was really rudimentary.
Yeah.
Because, for example, Heinrich Himmler, who was the head of the SS, thought it was unnecessary to teach Polish children how to read.
Because in the end, they should learn how to serve the Germans.
Right. So they were basically going to be used for labor, sort of exclusively.
Yes, they were going to be this leaderless sort of lumpen proletariat that would be kept on as basically slaves to serve the German masters.
On October 12, 1939, the Nazis issued a decree automatically revoking all Polish national citizenship, thereby rendering the population stateless. This paved the way for the imposition of the Germanization program, whereby the Nazis embarked on the complete destruction of Polish life and culture, which was to be replaced by an ethnically German national community. With the entire Polish population stripped of its citizenship, rights, and statehood, the Nazi administration began to pick and choose which Poles could be Germanized and which ones had to be removed or eliminated. Eventually, 700,000 ethnic Poles were evicted from Greater Poland in the western and central part of the country and relocated to the south. Their land and homes were handed over to 500,000 German nationals. Ethnic Poles were segregated from all German spheres of activity, reducing them to a life of forced labor. Jews were treated even more harshly, gunned down, beaten, ghettoized, and enslaved into forced labor camps.
Okay, so Janina's in Lublin. We now get a sense of what is going on there, and it is absolutely horrific. And this is when she sort of starts to stand up and find a role for herself.
She reached the point where she realized that it was probably not likely that she would survive the war. For example, her husband was almost captured in a raid. And if he had been taken, a physical exam would immediately have shown that he was a Jew because he was circumcised. You know?
Yeah.
And so she had been so frantically worried about how they were going to survive. But then suddenly she decided, hey, you know what? How am I going to live the rest of my life?
Yeah.
And how am I going to die a meaningful death?
Right.
That should be my focus.
Yeah.
And so that's when she persuaded Count Szczęsny, who was in the resistance, to help her also get into the Polish Home Army, which she did under her alias, because Jews weren't always welcome there. And then Szczęsny got appointed to be the head of the Polish Main Welfare Council, which is called the RGO, for the entire district of Lublin. There were five districts in what was called the general government, the part of occupied Poland that they lived in. And he needed somebody with a good head for figures and fluent German.
Yeah.
And who could serve both, you know, interact both with the Germans and with their clients, and would also be acceptable to the other leaders of the RGO, who were mostly aristocrats. So he knew the perfect person, Countess Sukadolska.
Mm-hmm. And we should explain a little bit, because it was like an interesting kind of governance system that they put in place, where you had the RGO, but also you had the Polish resistance, and Janina was a member of both.
So nothing was done without the approval of the Germans. And when we say about the creation of the Main Welfare Council, I mean, that was an organization that was in existence during World War I to help Poles. And it kind of got resurrected during World War II, but with the Germans' approval.
Right.
So there was an umbrella of welfare organizations, and there was the main welfare council that was supposed to cater only to non-Jewish Poles.
Okay.
There was the Jewish social self-help that worked only with Jews.
Yeah.
And another organization only for Ukrainians in Poland. So you can see the separation right there.
Yeah.
And so Janina, as Barry mentioned, she immediately also saw an opportunity for herself to be involved, but also to help others through her participation in this main welfare council. The Polish resistance, it was separate from the main welfare council, of course.
Right.
And so not everyone who was in the main welfare council was a member of the resistance, and vice versa. I mean, you had to have a sponsor in order to enter the Polish resistance. You had to be trusted to be a part of it.
Yeah.
And so Janina went through different steps in order to join the Polish resistance.
Uh-huh.
But also to be employed by the RGO, she had to prove Aryan ancestry.
Wow.
So the RGO provided all different kinds of aid for Poles. So Poles who were forcibly displaced in ethnic cleansing operations, and Germans would just clear them out of their homes and farms and communities to make way for German settlers and just dump them, usually far away, mm-hmm. with no provision for their shelter or food. And so the RGO would, you know, take them under, you know, provide them with shelter and food and try to help them get work.
Yeah.
It ran soup kitchens and orphanages and clinics. It helped hundreds of thousands of Poles.
It sounds like an amazing institution.
Yeah, it is. And it really deserves to be studied more.
Absolutely. And it was a private institution, really, it seems like.
It was a volunteer organization of Poles.
And it got its funding and it seems like supplies from the Polish people, wealthier people. Like the Germans, maybe they were giving it some support, but I didn't get the impression that it was very much.
The majority of the funding and the goods came from the Polish population. And this is something that a very strong point that we wanted to make in the book about the participation of ordinary Poles who were going through many hardships themselves. And still, they managed to donate food, which the farmers were under quotas from the Germans. They had to fulfill certain quotas, and still they managed to somehow donate food, clothes, money, but also other things for children, even toys.
Yeah,
all various things that we can read about in the archival documents. And it was an amazing institution, really.
Yeah.
But it existed with the participation of a network of people who were part of the organization and who volunteered to participate in it.
Yeah, and they seemed to be very generous because whenever Janina needed anything, it appeared. They responded. And their lives are, as you say, they're living under quotas. Their lives are very difficult as well, but they...
Yeah, I mean, their rations are, you know, no more than a third of the calories that people need to survive. And most of that was carbohydrates. You know, they have no fats, they have no meat.
Yeah.
Yeah, so malnutrition was quite common.
Wow.
Yeah, and then they were suffering terribly. And yet they were And you think about another thing that the Poles did was, so the Germans abducted more than 2 million ethnic Poles for forced labor in the Reich in Germany.
Yeah.
And most of these were able-bodied adults who were separated from their children and their parents.
Yeah.
And so Poles were taking in these children. And that's why the RGO ran orphanages, mm-hmm. because the parents of these children have been abducted.
Yeah. Incredible story there in and of itself about how the Poles responded and sort of helped one another under the most difficult circumstances, which is something they have should be very proud of. I mean, that's a pretty remarkable thing. So can you talk now about sort of how Janina became more active as time went on and involved with the RGO and also the underground activities in Poland?
Her first, before she joined the RGO, she was working as a courier mm-hmm. for the underground, which is a very common job for women in the resistance. And our book talks some about the role of women in the resistance and the many different women that Janina worked with in both her relief and her resistance work. She also would listen to illegal broadcasts like from the BBC, you know, take them down, translate them, encode them, and pass them on. But then once she was at the RGO, she and Szczynski had the very important services that they could provide for the resistance, because she was the one responsible for getting approval of RGO identity cards from the Germans for the RGO employees. Mm-hmm. Those identity cards, those work cards, allowed them to travel about, to go and talk to people at different sites at transit camps and elsewhere. So they were very, very useful for people who were in the resistance. So she was able to ensure to embed an increasing number of members of the resistance in the RGO and its local affiliates in Lublin District.
Can you talk a little bit about the concentration camp that was in Lublin?
Yes.
Because it's not that well known to most people, but it was obviously a very important place.
Yes, Majdanek concentration camp. That's been a surprise for Joanna and me, is how few people today have heard of it. But in 1945, it was more notorious than even Auschwitz.
Really?
Because it was the first major camp to be liberated by the Soviet forces in July 1944, and the first place that they found physical evidence that the Nazis were murdering people in stationary gas chambers. Mm-hmm. So they invited in foreign journalists and did pictures and videos, and Majdanek featured in a film that was shown at the Nuremberg trial of Nazi leaders. Mm-hmm. So it was quite famous at one time. But today, apparently, few people outside of Poland have heard of it.
I had never heard of it.
And Majdanek was, it served a variety of functions. It was such a hellhole, I really can't adequately describe it.
Yeah,
that in 1943, it had by far the highest mortality rate of all of the concentration camps.
Yeah.
Auschwitz was a distant second.
Yeah.
So prisoners lived there often in uninsulated horse barracks with no windows. There was no running water. The water in the wells was contaminated. Their latrines were concrete ditches out in the open, you know, in Poland, in the central Poland.
Oh, my God.
Just boards running across where they would perch. And they couldn't wash themselves after relieving themselves. You know, dysentery was epidemic there.
Yeah.
Because they would go often for a month or more without any opportunity to bathe or any change of clothing. They were fed worse than prisoners in the concentration camps in Germany. And what food they got, they had to pass around in unwashed bowls. So, of course, epidemics became rampant.
Yeah.
And then these starving, sick prisoners had to perform harsh physical labor 11 hours a day, 6 days a week.
Yeah.
Unsurprisingly, many prisoners died within 3 weeks of arriving.
Sure.
Yeah.
Sure.
So, as I said, Majdanek served several purposes. One was it was part of Aktion Reinhardt, which was the largest mass murder operation in the Holocaust. Mm-hmm. So for comparison, about a million Jews were murdered at Auschwitz. 1.7 million were murdered in Axion-Reinhardt, most of them in the gas chambers at Belzec, Sobibor, and Treblinka. But as part of the operation, able-bodied Jews between ages 16 and 35 were selected out and sent to perform forced labor at Majdanek and some other special labor camps for Jews. Once, of course, they became unable to work, then the ones at Majdanek were murdered there. So that was a part of it. And then when the killing centers were running out of capacity, Majdanek was sometimes used also as a killing center, where whole transports of Jews, men, women, and children were sent and selected, and those not able to work were murdered, most by shooting, but there were also gas chambers at Majdanek.
Mm-hmm. And you have a map in the beginning of the book. Mm-hmm. Concentration camp was right in the city, so the people who lived there, this was just a constant presence. There was no way that you could not be aware of what was going on there.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Yeah.
So then in 1943, Majdanek also became a camp for thousands of non-Jewish Polish prisoners. This was part of Heinrich Himmler's push to get more prisoners into the concentration camps to be used for forced labor.
Yeah.
And that's when the RGO finally gets standing. They had been trying to get aid to prisoners there, but unsuccessfully. But once there's thousands of Polish prisoners there, they finally get some standing to send in some aid.
Yeah.
It was also a place where civilians who were seized in anti-partisan operations and ethnic cleansing operations were dumped. So a lot of these were women, children, elderly civilians from Belarus and also Polish. And then in 1944, it became a so-called convalescent camp, which meant that other concentration camps sent to there the prisoners who had become too injured or ill to work. And then they were just left there to die.
Mm-hmm. As you mentioned, when they start sending in Poles from other areas, this really presents the RGO with an opportunity. And this is really when Janina starts to step up. Can you talk about that for a little? Because that's really when you see her character, when she goes in and deals with the SS commandants and these other very extreme characters. Mm-hmm. And she's able to never lose her cool and sort of never lose her dignity with these people who are absolutely despicable and are treating people with, you know, just horrific ways. And yet it's almost like reach their humanity in a certain way and get them to respond. People who you wouldn't think would be open to that at all and didn't seem to be at first. And yet she's able to get them to allow soup and other supplies to get into the prison.
The RGO was making every effort to reach the German authorities in Lublin since the occupation started, and since the Majdanek concentration camp was created, to bring help. But they were not successful. But they kept pressing. And there was, you know, timing mattered, right? So at a specific time, February 1943, that's when Janina Skrzyński and another member of the aristocrat from the Main Welfare Council meet with the German authorities, because finally they found kind of an in into the camp, right?
Mm-hmm.
And at that time, what was happening at that time? Barry just mentioned a lot of prisoners in Majdanek concentration camp was overflowing with people.
Yeah.
At the same time, the German authorities were interested in using forced labor, right? But how do you use forced labor if these people are dying?
Yeah.
They're emaciated. They don't have food, medication, and so on. So it was also in the Germans' interest to preserve the lives of these prisoners.
Mm-hmm.
And Janina knew this perfectly well.
Mm-hmm.
And she managed to, every time she met with the Germans, and she managed to persuade them in a way that it, to show that this was actually this would actually benefit the Germans, right? It's not she's doing it to sustain the Poles,
right?
But there was an interest to that. And Rolf, you mentioned, her character and how she was able to do that. And I think we also have to say something about how successful she was, Janina was, in masquerading as an aristocrat, as a non-Jewish Pole. We cannot imagine she did not feel fear. We know very well that she did.
Yeah, of course.
But the fact that she hid it so well.
Yeah.
It's absolutely amazing, right? From our perspective, to, you know, talking about it today.
Yeah.
How she managed to do that.
Right.
But, you know, when we first started the conversation, you asked about her background, right? And we talked about her background. Mm-hmm. So here you have this woman who internalized many of these mannerisms of the Polish nobility, mm-hmm. Their way of speaking, mm-hmm. But also she was fluent in German, so she had this advantage when meeting with the members of the German authorities, mm-hmm. and she used the entire package to the fullest, and that really allowed her to do these amazing, fantastic things to bring relief aid. For prisoners in Majdanek, but also beyond Majdanek in the Lublin district.
Majdanek was a Nazi concentration camp built on the orders of SS leader Heinrich Himmler on the outskirts of the city of Lublin in October 1941. A total of 130,000 men, women, and children of various nationalities were imprisoned there during the war. In the first period of the camp's operation, most of the prisoners were Soviet POWs to be used as a free workforce for the Third Reich's expansion in the East. Most of them died due to the primitive living conditions, rampant typhus epidemics, and brutal treatment by the camp guards. The high mortality was exacerbated by arduous work and by direct forms of murder, such as drowning in sewage pits, hangings, beatings, or phenol injections. By August 1943, there were 16,206 prisoners in the main camp, of which 9,105, or 56.18%, were Jews, and the rest non-Jewish Poles. Mass executions by firing squad and gas chambers took place throughout the camp's existence, the largest of which happened on November 3rd, 1943, when in a single day, approximately 18,000 Jews from Majdanek and other labor camps in Lublin were murdered. The official estimate of the victims of Majdanek was determined in 2005 to be 78,000 dead, including at least 59,000 Jews. And at the same time, having a domestic life with her husband, I wonder, I don't know if you know this, what he felt about all of this, that his wife was exposing probably not only herself to danger, but him as well, with every one of these visits, because at any point she could have been discovered.
Yes.
And some of these visits were not so friendly. That she would go in and she would be attacked initially, and then she'd sort of wear these people down with the arguments that you presented, Joanna. I don't know if it was in the manuscript or not, what her relationship with Henry was throughout this period.
She doesn't really write about that. We know Henry was, he wrote a preface to the memoir, which contained all of the biographical information that we had to start with, mm-hmm. because she provided none in her memoir. It starts September 1st, 1939, and July 1944. She doesn't even provide her name, but you know, some people refer to her as Janina, in the memoir. But other than that, and she was a math teacher, that's all you know, and the daughter of a landowner.
Yeah.
So, we know he was very proud of her what he wrote in the preface, from his efforts after she died to get her story told.
Yeah.
She, after the war, when they were living in the United States, she never talked about what happened. But Henry would sometimes say that she was a heroine of the resistance, that she saved him.
Yeah.
He said he was an egg farmer. he worked for an agricultural co-op. Mm-hmm. I think she wanted him to be, you know, well out of sight.
Yeah. No, it was a good arrangement, actually, for
in
them.
In an unobtrusive position. And I feel pretty certain that she had plans in place for if something happened to her.
Yeah.
You know, where he would go, right?
Yeah. No, she was obviously a very smart woman and also had made, she was making connections all the time mm-hmm. within these different communities, within the resistance, within the RGO mm-hmm. and also among the German leadership, you know, within the area. And then she started using, they were giving her permission to bring in soup and other supplies to the Germans, and she developed a system where they started to smuggle out information.
Yes, she as I mentioned, my Dominic had the highest mortality rate in 1943. And at that time, that was not a good thing to Heinrich Himmler because he wanted the prisoners to be able to work in the arms industries. So my Dominic got a new commandant in the fall of 1943. And she was able to get permission to start bringing in prepared soup and special breads and rolls for sick prisoners at Majdanek. And the two, there were five compounds, the two had infirmaries.
Not only did she started with just the sick prisoners and the two compounds,
right.
But she was continually pressing for more.
Yes.
And each time she's pressing for more, she's exposing herself, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then she takes it as far as like, well, I want to develop a system where the people who are helping me in the camp smuggle out messages so that the other side of this, which is the Polish resistance, gets more information to be able to anticipate what is happening in the camp.
Yeah. So the key development is she gets permission to deliver this soup, and not just to the camp gate, but she wangles her way into getting a pass to go inside the camp to each one of the compounds to deliver the soup and rolls. Eventually she won permission to deliver it to all the compounds and then for increasing numbers of days of the week.
Yeah.
And so she would bring these deliveries and she would meet up with a prisoner detail that would unload the trucks of the contents that she brought in. And she had, for example, the soup cans fitted with false bottoms so that she could smuggle in messages and supplies for the resistance, and then they could smuggle out messages.
Mm-hmm.
She could communicate a little bit surreptitiously mm-hmm. with these people. And so she helped organize the resistance in the camp. Every one of these prisoner details had at least one comrade of hers from the Polish Home Army mm-hmm. in it. And so she was able to communicate with them and then help them communicate with resistance members in other compounds. So then they're able to set up a central resistance organization within the camp.
And it got to the point where she was basically delivering soup and supplies to every part of the camp.
Yes.
She was so successful, she just kept breaking down barrier after barrier, and it seemed almost established a trust with the Germans who were running the camps.
Yeah, she was just relentless in pressing her advantages. When she was told no, she just took that as a sign she needed to find another way to get to yes.
Yeah.
And that often included going over the head of the person who told her no.
Yeah.
And if she got yes, she said, well, that's an invitation to ask for more. So she saw the SS weren't actually looking to see what quantity she was delivering. She increased them. She increased the kinds of food. She was slipping in fats, like pats of butter and stuff, which were really key.
Which they wouldn't have agreed to in the beginning.
No. She was just supposed to be bringing in soup and bread. So she just kept pushing ahead and bringing in more and more. And she befriended some of the SS people there who helped her,
mm-hmm.
including a key official who was working in the commandant's headquarters,
mm-hmm.
who gave her that pass to get into the camp.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this also points to how well she could read people. In order to get what she wanted. And we mentioned, you know, the connections, right? And forge these connections with the guards, with the right kind of guards,
right,
who showed more kind of empathy, maybe.
Yeah.
But they didn't know what she was really doing, right? But she had a way of speaking with these people.
Yeah. And there's a couple instances where she's called under suspicion. Can you talk about that? Because there was definitely danger points during this process. It isn't all just she's winning every battle and there's no, you know, it's running smoothly. I mean, there's just a constant fear of being discovered. And by putting herself out there also, you know, she's got more visibility. So people can start to question, like, what is this woman really up to?
Right. Yeah. So particularly the head of the protective custody camp, which is the area of the camp that held the prisoners, was this SS Lieutenant Tumar, extremely cruel person. He was hated by his men as much as by the prisoners because he was a real sadist.
Yeah.
And he hated Yanina and did not want to allow her to bring anything in, but she was able to get the backing of the commandant. Who wanted to reduce the prisoner mortality rate. So, but Tumon was always, you know, on her case, looking to find a way to capture her, to, you know, expose her. He believed that she was, you know, doing resistance work in the camp. And he very nearly did catch her a couple of times.
Yeah, he almost did.
So, and that was, you know, when it was really key, her ability just to stay completely calm.
Yeah.
While he was screaming in her face and pulling out his pistol, you know, that was so key.
Yeah.
And then also, I mean, the SS, the Gestapo suspected her. So they set some traps for her. Mm-hmm. She knew that there were informants, prisoners who were turned informant in the camp, so she couldn't know for sure who they were.
Yeah.
She entered the camp with a healthy dose of paranoia.
Yeah.
Always.
Yeah.
And she always had to be careful. I think we need to just also remember that no one except Andrei Skrinsky, her rescuer, knew that she was Jewish.
Yeah.
So she was in danger every day and from various people. And she writes about this in her memoir, that there were people had different attitudes, exhibited different behavior. And she could be denounced from among the Polish population.
Sure.
So she had to be very careful, constantly on her toes.
Yeah. And she obviously played the part of the countess very well.
Yeah.
No, that never broke. She always maintained that sense of herself. So it sounds like that played a big part in people just sort of accepting who she was.
Mm-hmm.
Like there was never any question that she was a countess.
As much as the Germans suspected her of resistance activities, we don't believe any of them ever suspected that she was Jewish.
Yeah.
And even the prisoners, even in their secret messages, thanking the countess, right? So they knew she was the countess after the war. In some of the accounts of survivors, she figured as the countess, right? So no one questioned that part of her identity.
Yeah. People should read the book because we're just sort of skipping over the main themes here. There's so much day-to-day danger and negotiation that is going on. And then, of course, the horrific things that continue to go on in the camp and these different populations of people who are brought in. And, you know, we'll leave this for people to read. But there's also a very dramatic interlude where they allow a bunch of children and mothers to leave the camp. And they're so weak, they can't even walk to the train. And Janina figures out a way to help them and rushes around and gets permission. So there's a tremendous amount of drama and of human suffering in this story. But let's move to periods of change are always dangerous. And as the Germans start to lose the war and the feeling, you know, within Lubin and the community is, well, this is coming to an end. Now what's going to happen?
This is on the cusp of liberation, right?
Okay.
Where she is still continuing to provide relief as the camp is being evacuated, right, of prisoners. Mm-hmm. She's still trying to be there and to bring in supplies and to plan a prisoner for prisoners to break out of and escape from a train, right?
Yeah.
So this is all part of the story.
Yeah.
And as the Soviet army is approaching Lublin, of course, Yanina is thinking about next steps.
Yeah.
And her next steps involve staying in the city and continuing to help Polish people who are affected by starvation and various injuries and homelessness and so on. So she stays in Lublin for some time after the war, while her supervisor and her rescuer, Andrei Skrzyński, is being forced out of his position.
Yeah.
Because of accusations hurled at him by the director of the Polish Red Cross that Skrzyński and the Polish Main Welfare Council collaborated with the Nazis.
Yeah.
And Skrzyński could not stomach that. And so he decides to leave Lublin, and the Main Welfare Council is being run by Yanina. This is after liberation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So when the Soviets came in, that was not the end of danger for her, because like Skrzyński, she had been in the Polish Home Army, which was the anti-communist resistance.
Yeah.
So the communists were rounding up members of the Polish Home Army and imprisoning them, executing some of them. They also suspected, rightly, that many members of the RGO served in the mm-hmm. in the Polish Home Army. And so they came under suspicion.
Yeah.
But at the same time, they needed the RGO services to continue.
Mm-hmm.
Yanina, she may have been tempted with the end of the war to go back to her original identity, but she seems to have decided that it was too dangerous and she wanted to continue her work. And she couldn't know how, she revealed that she was not Countess Suchodolska and really a Jew. She didn't know how her co-workers would take that.
Yeah.
Yeah, so she became, instead of Countess Suchodolska, she became Dr. Suchodolska, social worker. And she ended up then going to Warsaw after once it was liberated and became the capital again. She became the deputy head of the Polish social welfare agency, the post-war one.
Mm-hmm.
And again, because of her foreign language abilities, she was the interlocutor with foreign relief organizations and international relief organizations that were providing funds and goods mm-hmm. To help the Poles.
Mm-hmm.
And so she's able to travel abroad some, make foreign contacts, which she uses to get Henry out. Henry wanted to go back to his academic career, so he reverted to his true identity, became a professor.
Mm-hmm.
At a couple of different universities. So they had to live apart. And she was able to find a way for him to get to Canada. And she hoped to join him. She was supposed to go to a conference, but suddenly her permission to travel abroad is cut off and she's trapped in Poland.
Mm-hmm.
Eventually, she found a way to escape. She showed up at the Canadian military mission in West Berlin and defected.
Yeah.
They ended up in Canada and then in the United States.
Wow. Now, has she ever been recognized in Poland?
Well, as a Jewish woman, no, never. I mean, this is the story that we uncovered.
Yeah.
And this is the story that we tell. And we do hope sincerely that she will be recognized for the work that she did as a Jewish woman in Poland.
I think she will be as a result of your book, absolutely.
Yeah.
And which she should be.
Yeah. So this story has never been told before.
Uh-huh.
It's completely unknown, and
and she kept it pretty much to herself during the rest of her life.
Yeah, except for towards the end of her life in the 1960s, she wrote this sort of memoir, which, as I said, only covered mm-hmm. certain aspects of her activities between 1939 and 1944.
Yeah. Was it still such a painful experience for her, or she you know, I did what I did. I don't need recognition. You know, it's such an extraordinary story. You would think that it had leaked out a little bit through relatives or friends, but it seemed like she led a very private life. Mm-hmm. I mean, look, I had a mother who didn't tell me a lot of details of her life until she was, you know, 93, 94. So, and she'd lived through a lot of trauma. So I know that people do this, but I'm just wondering how you feel about that.
For Anina, she was a very humble person.
Yeah.
And that's one thing. Another thing is that, yes, she was a private person. And I think that there was always this fear of disclosing too much information about herself and not to compromise other people
yeah.
who were still living in Poland,
right.
such as her rescuer, Skrzyński, right?
Yeah.
Who continued to live in Poland after the war.
Yeah.
And other people with whom she was working during the war and after the war. So I think there was fear in that.
Yeah.
She was so private to the point that we've learned from her former students and Henry students who used to come to their home in Chicago that they didn't even know that Janina was Jewish. They thought this was a Polish lady.
Yeah.
They had no clue what she was doing during the war.
Yeah.
We relatively recently, after finishing the book, which already tells you that we are still interested in the story, we're still uncovering information.
Mm-hmm.
And we spoke with Henry's niece,
mm-hmm.
who lived with the Melbergs in Chicago when the niece was going to high school. And she told us that, yes, Janina would mention snippets of that of the information. So the niece knew about this.
Yeah.
The immediate family knew about this, but no one else.
Yeah.
And I think there were many reasons. And Barry has, you know, thought about the reasons why Janina wrote the memoir at the time when she did. And maybe can talk more about, you know, the kind of the format of it, the types of information that is contained and how it's geared toward a specific maybe audience.
Okay.
But I do want to mention that in 1968, so a year before Janina passed away, there was an anti-Semitic, so-called anti-Zionist campaign going on in Poland, during which thousands of Polish Jews and Poles of Jewish descent were removed from their positions in the government, were harassed, and were pushed out of Poland to immigrate, mostly to Israel.
Wow.
So, of course, Janina was aware of that. And this, for many survivors, many Holocaust survivors in Poland, brought memories that there another Holocaust is possible.
Right. And as you point out in the book, it was hard to know who to trust in Poland. Even the Red Cross at the end was exposing people because they had been cooperating to a certain extent with the Germans. So it was a treacherous political shifting landscape.
I would just also like to add that it was very common for Holocaust survivors not to talk about what happened to them. In fact, very few Holocaust survivors came forward to try to describe what couldn't be described, you know, their terrible losses and suffering.
Yeah.
So that started to change in the 1960s with the trial of Adolf Eichmann in Israel, which used Holocaust survivors as witnesses. It was televised around the world. It was recapped on the nightly news in the U.S. And it really suddenly grabbed people's attentions. First time people became aware of the Holocaust. In fact, it's when the word Holocaust began to be used to describe what had happened to the Jews.
Yeah.
And so this did help more Jews to come forward to talk and write about what they experienced. Still, many didn't. I worked on Nazi cases at the Justice Department, and often you would find a survivor of a crime you were investigating and asked to interview that person, and the children were asked to sit in because their parent had never talked about their lives before 1945. So Janina, I think that was part of it. And part of it also was this growing anti-Semitism in Poland that was expressed also in how the Holocaust was framed. You know, so suddenly It's the Poles were all heroic and tried to save the Jews, but the Jews were passive,
right,
and didn't do anything to save themselves.
Yeah.
And then these Jews now who are coming forward and talking about what they suffered, and sometimes, and they're acknowledging their Polish rescuers, but also talking about the anti-Semitism and danger that they faced from Poles.
Sure.
That they're erasing Polish suffering, right? And they're ungrateful.
Mm-hmm.
And so Janina's memoir, we think, was written for a Polish audience to counter this kind of narrative,
mm-hmm.
Because she writes very, very little
yeah.
about the Jews and and about her feelings of
being Jewish,
you know, being a Jew in this situation, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, instead of this narrative of passivity, she was not passive.
No, right?
She was not ungrateful to her rescuer. She's recording. Nobody knew what Shkinsky did. Even his own family didn't know what he did during the war.
Yeah.
Right. So she's talking about these people she worked with and their heroic efforts to help the Poles survive.
Right.
And she's also showing that she herself, she was a Polish patriot. She risked her life to save some fellow Poles.
Yeah.
But there were still, you know, as we said, you know, some amazing things she did that she didn't write about, including what you alluded to when she arranged for the release of over 2,000, mostly women, children, and elderly prisoners from Majdanek, who were in such a horrible physical state.
Horrible.
And many of hundreds of them died. And I think that was just, for her, instead of a memory of a success, a memory of real trauma.
Oh, sure.
And
oh,
failure that she hadn't gotten them out sooner.
Right. It's hard to know how people process horror like that and death like that. But she had the resolve and the strength to sort of deal with all that and still go on, which for, I think, most people would just break them, freeze them. In the end, it's just a story of just an amazing spirit. And despite her identity, how she is able to overcome everything and just keep her eye on what the most important thing is, which is to save as many people as possible, no matter who they are. And she didn't make any distinction. She just, you know, wanted to help people in need. And that's the most beautiful human impulse right there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I mean, what a heroine. And really, hopefully, a heroine who is embraced by the Polish people, because it is, in the end, a very positive portrayal of the Polish people, because, you know, so many of them came forward to help, like we spoke about before, all the soup and all the supplies, they provided them. Janina just had to ask, and it would appear. Well, thank you so much. This has been fantastic. Do you have anything you want to add before we go?
We're just very, very grateful to you for your interest in the book and for talking to us today. It's been a pleasure. Your questions have been wonderful.
What a remarkable woman.
Thank you so much for giving us this platform to share Janina's story and for, you know, steering also the discussion to talk about the Polish experience during World War II.
There are all these people in all walks of life who have done like amazing things. And it's what's great about it, you know, like Janina, it's not about politics. It's just about, you know, humanity and stepping up and doing things. These stories need to be told. So thank you guys for writing this book. It's very inspiring for people to hear stories like this. It's not all bad. Like, it's horrible, horrible situation. No question about it. Unimaginably horrible. But people do step up, and let's celebrate them.
That's absolutely true. You said it very well. Yes. Thank you.
There's no doubt in my mind that Dr. Josephine Janina Mellberg was a remarkable woman who, growing up privileged in Eastern Galicia, which is now part of Ukraine, probably expected a life of a female intellectual and scholar in mathematics and philosophy, which was rare in itself in the late 1930s. But did she ever imagine she would face the horrors of war or be displaced from her home? Or have to hide her Jewish identity with her husband in order to survive in Nazi-occupied Poland? Or did she expect that she would choose to impersonate a Polish aristocrat named Countess Janina Sukudolska, because as a countess, she could help save her fellow Jews and Poles from starvation, illness, and death? But that came to be. And she faced all those challenges because of her strength of character, heart, and courage, and made an enormous difference in thousands of desperate people's lives. Despite all she did and all the people she helped and saved, Janina Mellberg never asked for recognition or awards. To my mind, she's the epitome of a hero and an inspiration. I thank authors Elizabeth B. White and Joanna Sliwa for sharing Janina Mellberg's remarkable story with us and for their excellent and very moving book, The Counterfeit Countess. It's my great honor to name Dr. Josephine Janina Mellberg and authors Elizabeth B. White and Joanna Sliwa as today's heroes behind the headlines.
Heroes Behind Headlines. Executive producer Ralph Fazzullo. Produced and engineered by Mike Dawson. Music provided by Extreme Music. For exclusive content, please join our Patreon group at patreon.com/heroesbehindheadlines.